Karen Routledge, Being a Girl Without Being a Girl, Gender and Mountaineering on Mount Waddington, 1926 to 1936, BC Studies, No. 141, Spring 2004. I live in a city shaped by mountains. I first realized this while standing on top of one. It is 8 a.m. on the summit of Mount Baker, a Cascade volcano just south of the American border. The summer morning is already scorching, snow glitters and melts at my feet. I am looking at the region where I have spent most of my life, but it has become another planet, alien, stunningly beautiful, yet somehow familiar. The view is dizzying. There's so much light, so much heat, so much air. All around me, peaks are stacked upon peaks, layers of paling blue fading into the sun-bleached sky. The sight of all this land at once is overwhelming. I know this place, but not like this. Ironically, while Mount Baker's snow-capped plateau is a prominent landmark to Vancouverites, the city is utterly insignificant from here. Vancouver lies buried somewhere to the northwest, a squat gray mass in a valley of haze and smog, a sprawling city limited by mountains in three directions. I look down at this map made real before me and finally understand the extent to which geography shapes the way we live. The mountains that surround Vancouver are far more than landmarks, sources of income, and tourist beacons. We have changed these mountains and been changed by them. From their slopes and summits, countless city people have glimpsed not only their home from a different perspective, but also their lives, values, and priorities. This article is about two of those people whose lives have been changed by mountains. 84 summers ago, a group of Vancouver mountaineers stood where I did, on the summit of Mount Baker, and looked out at much the same scene. Although the city was smaller, the glacier larger, and the crevices opened in a different pattern, the crumpled land stretched out before these climbers in much the same way as it does today. Mount Baker was, of course, a much less accessible destination then, but this particular trip proceeded smoothly until the descent, when a man's footing gave way above a steep slope of loose rock. Immediately, instinctively, a woman in the party jumped below him in order to break his fall. She herself began to slide, by which time the man had steadied himself. He reached out and stopped her. This couple barely knew each other, yet both appreciated that they had found someone on whom they could rely in an emergency and felt they shared a special instinctive connection. They continued to climb together nearly every weekend, and a year later they were married. Together, they would explore large areas of the coast mountains, frequently traveling and climbing for weeks in isolated areas. Their lifelong devotion to each other and to the mountains, combined with their similar desire for adventure, would make Dawn and Phyllis Munday, née James, two of the most renowned mountaineers in Canadian history. History itself is often about looking at familiar places from distant, unfamiliar vantage points. In this article, I travel through words up into the coast mountains. From here, I discuss Phil Munday's experience of being a woman on climbing expeditions overwhelmingly dominated by men. In order to get to the tops of mountains, Phil Munday often had to step out of the boundaries of acceptable middle-class womanhood and challenge contemporary notions of what was possible for a woman. Through her actions, she contested both the feminine domestic stereotype and that of the masculine mountaineer. Her presence on the expeditions fundamentally questioned what it meant to be a woman and climber, and by extension, a man. The fact that Dawn, Phil, and their friends thought Mount Baker would be an enjoyable place to spend a long weekend reflects that, by 1919, mountaineering had become a recognized and relatively popular pastime in Canadian cities. Around the turn of the 20th century, a small group of Vancouver climbers had begun to explore the local peaks of the coast mountains. From 1906 and 1907, respectively, the Vancouver section of the Alpine Club of Canada, the ACC, and the British Columbian Mountaineering Club, the BCMC, provided meeting and learning places for Vancouverites who went hiking and climbing in the mountains on weekends and holidays. While these clubs officially represented a cross-section of Vancouver society, in practice, their members tended to be middle class, of British descent, and employed in office jobs that were neither physically strenuous nor full of risk. Women made up a significant portion of the membership, approximately 40% in the case of the ACC, but they were far less likely than men to participate in extended, unguided mountaineering trips. Dawn and Phyllis Munday were active club members before meeting each other, but they did not greatly diverge from the stereotypical climber profiles until after their marriage and the birth of their only child, Edith, in 1921. In 1923, they accepted positions as resort managers of a proposed development on Grouse Mountain and moved first to a tent and then to a cabin they built on the mountain. When the resort failed to materialize, Dawn and Phil moved to North Vancouver, where they lived until close to their deaths. After their marriage, neither of them held a long-term job that was not related to outdoor activities. Dawn was a freelance journalist who wrote largely about climbing, and Phil, as well as being a housewife and mother, was a devoted volunteer in the Girl Guide movement and the St. John's Ambulance Society. The Mundays were also very enthusiastic members of the ACC. They regularly attended club meetings, where they often gave lectures about their trips. Phil sat on the ACC executive, helped to plan social events, edited the local newsletter and the Canadian Alpine Journal, lobbied for various club interests, and judged photo contests. Outdoors, she and Dawn led day or weekend trips and climbing seminars, and went backcountry skiing with their club friends in the local mountains. Phil stopped her serious exploratory climbing after Dawn's death in 1950, but she remained a committed ACC member until she died in 1990. To mountaineers, the Mundays are remembered best for their exploratory trips to the Mount Waddington region, a few hundred kilometers north of Vancouver. At 4,019 meters, Mount Waddington is the highest mountain in southern Canada, and it is a renowned and challenging mountaineering destination today. However, when the Mundays first looked out toward Mount Waddington from a viewpoint up the Homathko River in 1925, they were astounded by what they saw. While the mountains in this area must have been important and obvious to local people, the Geographical Survey Board had not yet mapped the region, and therefore urban mountaineers were unaware of its topography. The Mundays became determined to reach this mountain and climb it. Dawn and Phil spent 7 of the 8 following summers on the glaciers surrounding Mount Waddington. They mapped the area, photographed it, gave names to its mountains, and made first ascents of many of the region's higher peaks. Yet, despite repeated grueling attempts to climb the mountain itself, they never reached its main summit. Ironically, their failures made them famous. Mount Waddington repeatedly made the front pages of Vancouver newspapers, and the Mundays' accounts were published in mountaineering journals, newspapers, and magazines in Canada, the United States, and Britain. The Mundays' stories and stunning photographs drew top local and international mountaineers to this unclimbable mountain. Mount Waddington became the most coveted summit in North America until an American team, Fritz Wisner and William House, climbed it in 1936. Nevertheless, it is the Mundays who remain most associated with the region today. A player of two games, Phil Munday as woman and climber. Anyone planning a trip to Mount Waddington in the 1930s would have heard of Dawn and Phil Munday. Renowned American climber Henry Hall certainly knew of them, and when he stopped in Vancouver in 1933 en route to Mount Waddington, he was lucky enough to run into Dawn Munday on the street. Henry immediately invited the Mundays to join his expedition, presumably hoping their expertise would increase his chances of success. His group was set to depart in 2 days, so Dawn and Phil spent their Sunday in a blur of packing and preparations. On the steamer to Squamish on Monday morning, Henry confessed that he would not normally have invited a woman on such an arduous trip. However, he had seen a photograph of Phil crossing Scar Creek in the 1927 Canadian Alpine Journal. It convinced him that Phil was a woman for whom exceptions could be made. Indeed, this photograph reflects the many ways in which Phil Munday challenged accepted notions of gender through her mountaineering. As Dawn Munday wrote, a woman such as Phil could be a girl without constantly reminding a fellow that she's a girl. She was easily among the most proficient Canadian mountaineers of the 1920s and 1930s, and she by no means relied upon her husband to get her to the summit. In this photograph, Phil is wearing men's clothing and nailed boots, and she is carrying a 60-pound packboard. This creek crossing was a harrowing experience for all involved, yet she remained calm and competent. This photograph, taken by Dawn's brother Bert on Phil's third crossing, captures the tenseness of Dawn and Phil's bodies, the foaming whiteness of the creek water, and the waves breaking over the shaking and shifting logs. Here, Phil is displaying qualities of athleticism, extreme courage and physical strength not widely associated with middle-class women in the 1920s and 1930s. Yet, what the above photograph does not reveal is the events leading up to it. Phil did not help build either this bridge or any of the expedition's other bridges. Instead, she prepared lunch while the men chopped down suitable trees and painstakingly dragged them into the river. This division of labor was typical for Dawn and Phil. While Phil clearly contested dominant notions of gender through her climbing, she and Dawn transplanted traditional gender roles to the mountains and upheld them as much as possible in their daily routines. Many past and present female mountaineers have overtly linked their climbing to a feminist agenda. While pre-1970s women climbers did not generally argue for a total breakdown of gender roles, there were many who considered their climbing part of a larger quest for women. The suffragist Julia Archibald Holmes climbed in the United States in the mid-1800s and wrote up her accounts in a woman's journal dedicated to social reform. In the early 1900s, Annie Smith Peck and Fanny Bullock Workman competed for the altitude record for women, making climbs in the Andes and the Himalayas. Workman was photographed in the Himalayas holding up a banner stating, "Votes for Women," and Peck wrote that she was a, quote, "firm believer in the equality of the sexes," end quote, and hoped that her climbing achievements would, quote, "be of advantage to her sex," end quote. In the 1920s, several women climbers, such as Miriam O'Brien, organized all-female expeditions, arguing that this was the only way they would be able to develop their skills as climbers and become equal to men. Yet Phil Munday does not fall into this category. She did not consider herself a feminist and refused to discuss her climbing in terms of gender. Her primary goal was not to break down female stereotypes, but, rather, to climb mountains. Her sense of self-worth was not just based on her climbing and backpacking achievements, but also on living up to her conventional notion of what a woman and a wife should be. As a friend remarked, Phil was always very much a lady, and she strove to remain so on expedition. In order to better analyze Phil Munday's role in the mountains, I consider her conflicting woman-climber identities as two games she played simultaneously. The anthropologist Sherry B. Ortner argues that everyone plays a multiplicity of games and that sometimes the rules of these games contradict each other. Any one game is always, quote-unquote, incompletely hegemonic. It is in these spaces of conflict between games that there arises the most viable room for change, or what Ortner terms, quote, "the slippages in reproduction, the erosions of long-standing patterns, the moments of disorder and outright resistance," close quote. Phil Munday tried to live up to two separate and conflicting ideals in the mountains. She played two games of identity. In the first game, the woman's game, she tried to play the role of the ideal middle-class woman and wife, subordinate, maternal, unassertive, nurturing, supportive, and at home in the domestic sphere. In the second, the climber's game, she attempted to become the ideal climber, assertive, adventurous, courageous, strong, stoic, heroic, and at home in the wilderness. Certainly, all identities are relational and shifting, and there is undeniably more overlap and complexity here than these generalized lists of attributes convey. However, it is important to remember that the ideal woman and the ideal climber were in most cases constructed as opposites and defined against each other. Their two games were not generally played by the same person or in the same place. The women's game and the climber's game also belong to two opposing fields, the city and the wilderness, respectively. Indeed, a society that constructs binaries such as male-female and nature-culture is not conducive to games that encourage overlap between these extremes. In trying to play both games at once on expedition, Phil had to compromise and bend the rules of both of them, thereby deeply challenging notions of gender, whether or not she intended to do so. A festive meal of ham, the women's game. On one of their earliest exploratory trips together, Dawn and Phil spent the first of many days cutting trail through dense forest. The most tedious section involves scrambling through a gully filled with the tall, spindly, thorny bush known as Devil's Club. The Munday's ensuing battle with this particular Devil's Club was typical of their division of labor. It was a joint effort, but also a separate one. All day, Dawn wielded the axe and chopped the trail. That evening, Phil painstakingly picked the thorns out of his hands and made him remain in his sleeping bag while she repaired the considerable damage to his clothes. quote, not only Arctic expeditions need a good needlewoman, end quote, Don remarked gratefully. Both Don and Phil played vital and central roles on every expedition. However, their roles were not interchangeable. While the men did much of the heavy work packing loads, Phil took care of the washing, mending, and cooking. She explained, while the boys were doing most of the relaying, I was doing washing and cooking and all sorts of household chores. Phil's tasks were related to those she presumably performed as a wife in the city. There were also practical reasons for this division of labor. Phil was far more skilled at domestic tasks than any of the men, and they were generally able to carry heavier loads. However, this division was at least in part practical because of socialization, and therefore it also reflected the dominant ideology of distinct male and female spheres. Phil's special tasks removed her from much direct contact with nature. She was the one who made the expedition comfortable and civilized. To use the battle imagery favored by many male climbers of this period, Phil was often behind the lines. The men advanced the expedition, and she made sure they could continue to do so. She replenished their hungry bodies with food, she repaired their equipment and clothing. She was also responsible for treating the many injuries, usually minor, that the climbers incurred. She looked out for everyone, especially the weaker members of the party. She insisted that the climbers travel at a slow and steady pace that everyone could manage, and she gave extra food to the weaker climbers, even when it was in short supply. Phil did much of the maintenance work, both physical and psychological, on the approaches. An image of Phil cooking in camp in 1926 shows the extent to which gender roles were both divided and compromised on expedition. Don titled it, Miss Monday Works Culinary Magic in the Kitchen. Yet this kitchen was certainly different from Phil's kitchen at home in the city. While it is probable that Phil did not have modern conveniences such as a refrigerator or a washing machine, she likely would have had running water and electricity, and certainly some kind of stove. Furthermore, if Phil pitched this camp, as she might have done, she would have had to cut tent and shelter poles, put up the tents that she had sewn out of sail canvas over the winter, and lash everything together securely. She would also probably have chopped the wood for the cooking fire. Even the camp equivalent of domestic tasks required greater strength than most middle-class women needed to cultivate. Although the Mondays took very few portraits, there are several similar photographs among their thousands of negatives. In two other photos from the 1926 expedition, the male climbers are eating, but Phil is a blurry figure moving between them, presumably serving them or checking if they have enough to eat. She can also be seen cooking, washing dishes, and serving food in the 1934 expedition video. These images corroborate Phil's descriptions in her diaries of cooking and feeding the party. This image also reveals the extent of the food and cooking equipment the expedition members had to carry. There are 7 or 8 pots and pans of various sizes, as well as many heavy tins of food. Dried eggs and Klim powdered milk, both visible in the picture, were staples. Similar pictures show cans of margarine, peanut butter, and custard powder. Other important foods included macaroni, pilot bread, dry biscuits, beans, rice, flour, butter canned in tins, various grains and dried fruits, sugar, jam, cheese, ham, bacon, and sardines. The Mondays also took lots of chocolate, nuts, and raisins, iron rations. Bannock, or pan bread, was a crucial food that could be baked in advance and carried onto the glaciers. When the party descended to the forest after its time above the tree line, Phil could make a special meal with heavier ingredients. On one occasion, she made, quote, a festive meal of ham, creamed carrots, fried potatoes, scrambled eggs, custard, and strawberry jam, close quote. On another unforgettable evening, she amazed the men by concocting donuts. As a friend of Phil's expressed it, it seemed that before our packs reached the ground, Phil had a hot malted chocolate drink for all of us. At the end of the hardest days, she would prepare delicious meals from seemingly simple ingredients, and dinner always included an interesting dessert. Finally, this photograph shows off Phil's clothing. Knickers, button-up shirt, and sweater. Virtually identical to what male climbers wore, some of it was almost certainly men's clothing. When asked in 1976 about dressing the same as the men, Phil shrugged off the question, as she did with most questions concerning her gender. It was just part of your equipment, she asserted. Yet the fact that there are no photos at all of men cooking reveals that even if men and women's clothes were similar, behavior on the expedition was less so. On the approaches to Mount Waddington, Phil tried to play the women's game mentally as well as physically. She was unassertive. She allowed Don to choose the campsites and kept quiet when she did not agree with his choices. She did not even insist on moving when, in one instance, she correctly surmised that the campsite Don had chosen would flood. Clearly, Phil did not like to contradict her husband, preferring instead to use her diary to express her unacceptable opinions and concerns. She wrote in the back of her 1939 diary, quote, "You have not fulfilled every duty unless you have fulfilled that of being pleasant," unquote. It appears that she considered this a duty even when it made her unhappy. Once, when she secretly wanted to go home and Don did not, Phil wrote, quote, "Oh, so terribly, terribly disappointed not to be going out to stay," close quote. She proceeded to lament to her diary for much of the following 10 days, confiding that she was dreadfully lonesome, awfully blue and homesick, and that there was no one friendly, even though Don was with her. Although Don was likely aware that Phil was unhappy on this occasion, it does not seem that she voiced her discontent or requested a change of plans. Phil also kept quiet about the inner conflict she experienced over her position as a mother. Most Canadian women in the 1920s and 1930s expected to marry and have children, and their motherhood was a vital part of their sense of self-worth, as well as a prime determinant of the respect others accorded them. Indeed, Phil was in a particularly unique position as a mother and a sportswoman. The vast majority of female athletes retired from competition after marriage and certainly after childbirth. Phil does not record whether she felt guilty or was criticized for leaving her small daughter with friends every summer, but she certainly missed Edith dreadfully. Most years, there is a photograph of Edith pasted into the front of her diary. She hated saying goodbye to her daughter, commented constantly on how much she missed her baby, and counted the days until she would see her again. One night in 1927, she remarked, quote, "Have that terribly tingly feeling again tonight about getting out. Feel terribly lonely for Edith," close quote. Phil clearly felt compromised by her dual career as both a mother and a climber, a sentiment that the fathers on the expedition do not express. Still, while Phil's attempts to balance her two identities sometimes made her miserable, she also took pride in her gender-specific skills. She made a point of telling an interviewer that her expeditions always had nicely cooked food. In her diary, she often recorded the dishes she made and commented when men complimented her meals. Phil was also quick to criticize the few men who tried their hands at cooking. She complained to her diary when she had to eat undercooked macaroni and beans prepared by two men. On another expedition, when the packers made soup and put egg in it, she commented, "Oh golly, what a mixture." Apparently this concoction made the party members, quote, "very wobbly around the waistline," close quote, and many were unable to climb well the following day. Indeed, the expeditions would not have been as well run or as well fed without her. On the first wash day of the 1926 trip, Phil discovered that one of the single male climbers had brought 16 pairs of socks, intending to throw them away rather than wash them. By being the only climber with substantial domestic skills, Phil carved out a unique space and made herself irreplaceable. She was the only Vancouver climber of her era playing both the women's game and the climber's game seriously, and she was proud of this. Phil, therefore, did not see her domestic role as subordinate. However, as appreciative as the men were of Phil's abilities, there is evidence that they ascribed a lower status to her jobs. Sometimes the Mondays invited young men in an apprentice capacity. These boys, as they were known, learned how to run an expedition and sometimes tackled a few lesser climbs. On three other expeditions, the Mondays accompanied the American climber Henry Hall, who hired packers and horses. These packers and the boys were enlisted to help with everything, including many of the tasks that normally fell to Phil, such as cooking and setting up camp. In other words, while male climbers were not expected to perform domestic tasks, the subordinate male helpers were, even if they had no more experience in cooking than the male climbers. This suggests that even though Phil did not view her role as inferior, the male climbers, consciously or not, considered themselves above the job she did. Although Phil's tasks were vital, and there was nothing inherently degrading about them, The male climbers reflected a prevalent view that Phil's chores were feminine and of a lesser value than those that they themselves performed. Indeed, by transporting the women's game to the mountains, Phil reinforced prevalent stereotypes about gender. When she performed domestic tasks on expedition, she was conforming to an accepted female role, and her presence exempted the male climbers from learning to do such work themselves. If Phil had not been there, then the men would have had to cook their own food, mend their own clothes, and do their own laundry, as they must have done on other mountaineering expeditions in the 1920s and 1930s, at least those without packers or guides. Phil's presence and willingness to do these tasks allowed men to uphold an ideal of frontline mountain travel as a masculine pursuit. However, at the same time, the women's game could not be transported to the mountains without its precepts being thrown into question. The nature of the expedition made a certain amount of heavy labor necessary for all participants. Phil may have done more cooking and less backpacking than most male climbers, but there were very few tasks that she did not perform on the approaches. She relayed loads, she navigated, she chopped trail with an axe, she rode across choppy seawater. Even Phil's domestic chores on the climbs differed substantially from those at home in North Vancouver. Phil was clearly stepping outside the boundaries of the city women's game, even if only because the environment demanded it. Furthermore, once the party reached the glaciers, Phil's performance as a climber offered an even deeper challenge to the premises of the women's game. Unfailing fortitude, unflinching courage, the climber's game. "Wind nearly tore us from the slope below the plateau edge," wrote Don Monday after yet another failed attempt on Mount Waddington. "I lowered my wife with the rope across the Bergschrund's fragile snow bridge. As it could not be jumped, I slid down, trusting she could anchor me if the bridge broke." The bridge held that time. There were other times when it did not, but the Mondays always managed to hold each other. When Don and Phil were tied into the same rope, their destinies were literally tied together. They worked as a team, playing much the same role. At such times, out of necessity, the climber's game superseded other games. Any mountaineer would rather have the mythical climber on his rope than the mythical domestic woman. If Phil was going to climb on serious, unguided expeditions, she had to learn to play the climber's game, and she did. Unlike most female, and many male, ACC members of her time, Phil Monday was a competent leader on rock, ice, and snow. Being first on the rope was extremely risky in the 1920s and 1930s. Climbers were generally careful not to lead beyond their limits, but accidents occasionally occurred. In 1934, on Mount Waddington, a young Vancouver climber slipped while leading a rock pitch and fell to his death. The accepted mountaineering techniques of the day afforded little protection to the leader, so a fall on ice or rock was often fatal. In general, women did not lead, and many people considered them to be physically and mentally incapable of doing so. It is questionable whether Dawn would have allowed Phil to expose herself to this kind of risk at all had it not been necessary. Sometimes, especially after dark, Dawn insisted on keeping Phil in the safer position. However, Dawn had been invalided home from the Great War in 1918 after being hit by shrapnel, and the wound had left his left arm clumsy and weak. For the rest of his life, he was unable to lead any technical rock climbs that required him to grab holds with his left arm. Indeed, abandoning gender roles could be a matter of necessity and convenience, as well as personal convictions or desires. Often, the Mondays simply did what they had to do to get where they wanted to go. Still, whether or not Phil would have learned to lead had it not been necessary, she came to consider leading a natural duty for all climbers, commenting in an interview that, of course, she and Don always alternated leads. Leading, she observed, was important for developing one's judgment in the mountains. Phil led over glaciers as well as on rock, even though Don's injury was far less of a hindrance on non-vertical snow and ice. This seems to be a case where Phil was making active use of the slippages between the women's and the climber's game to resist gender roles and to create her own identity. Since she climbed almost exclusively with men, she could have done what most women did and simply allowed the men to lead. Yet, according to Dawn, on at least one occasion she insisted on leading, quote, "among the worst of the masked crevasses," close quote. Learning to lead over all terrain must have also been a pragmatic choice for Phil. Her expertise made the expedition safer. On the glaciers, she and Don were able to relieve each other and travel further without becoming exhausted. In one instance, Don and his brother became snowblind, and Phil had to lead them down the glacier. Another time, Don became ill on a descent, and Phil immediately took over leadership. The party could feel her calm strength, and according to one of those present, she saved their lives. In general, the more risky the situation, the more the women's game, with its notions of passivity and weakness, was abandoned. In addition to risk-taking and leadership, being a good climber meant coping with physical pain. Once, Phil checked Dawn's fall, and his ice axe sliced her thigh so deeply it bared the tendon. Another time, while leading a rock climb, a falling rock smashed into Phil's skull. Blood seeped immediately through her kerchief, and she fought to maintain consciousness. Still, she never let go of the cliff, quote, "'cause I knew very well that if I fell, I would drag Dawn off." Close quote. While the women's game certainly required its players to endure pain and take risks, most notably in childbirth, the ability to stoically endure physical injuries was a stereotypically masculine attribute. Yet, like the best players of the climber's game, Phil was willing to endure injury and pain in order to get herself and her climbing companion safely to the summit and back again. While the Mondays most often encountered life-threatening situations on the glaciers, they were occasionally called upon to save each other in the valleys as well. The Mondays shared the Waddington region with bears. According to a manuscript of Dawn's, these bears were not the somewhat chastened bears of national parks, but unintimidated lords of the wilderness. The Mondays saw grizzlies glissading on snow slopes and passed unawares within a few meters of grizzlies on thickly forested riverbanks. They learned to follow bear tracks to find river crossings, while the bears quickly discovered the Mondays' newly cut trails and used them. However, the Mondays never had a serious encounter with a bear until 1936. It all began when they spied a young grizzly, perhaps 2 years old, across a meadow. Delighted, Phil and Henry Hall whipped out their cameras, and Dawn began filming. In the 1930s, even many seasoned backcountry travelers like the Mondays did not keep their distance from bears. The Mondays also took photographs of a bear stealing bannock out of their camp pan and of Dawn playing with a bear cub. A grizzly at close range was a photographic opportunity not to be missed. Phil wrote that she had fleetingly wondered where the mother was, but decided this cub was big enough to be on its own. They waited, hoping it would come closer. Quote, "Just then I heard a terrific roar," Phil wrote in her diary. She turned around. A mother grizzly and 2 yearling cubs were charging her from behind. Phil and Dawn shouted and yelled at the bears, diverting the charge. The mother bear then charged straight at Phil. Dawn jumped in front of his wife, waving his hat in a desperate attempt to distract the bear, which stopped 2 meters from him. Phil then seized an ice axe and threatened the bear with it. Dawn retreated slowly with the bear following him. He backed himself over a small cliff, and the bear ran away. Phil rushed over to see if he was safe, and Dawn urged her to leave him and climb a tree. She would not. Thankfully, the bear did not return. Phil confessed that this was the worst experience they ever had in the mountains. Quote, "It was a horrible experience. I just go goose skinny even now. After all these years, it's too close for comfort." Close quote. Yet, even at her most terrified, Phil was willing to risk her life to save Dawn. As Dawn wrote, quote, "In any dangers, Phil never wavered in devotion or courage." Close quote. In popular discourse, heroic acts of courage and rescue have typically been linked far more to men than to women. While women can be deemed heroines for taking care of others, it is generally their husbands who are willing to die for their wives, their country, or their comrades. However, although the Mondays reworked their manuscript drafts to hide this fact, Henry Hall had disappeared as soon as the grizzly charged, while Phil and Dawn had stayed to protect each other. Dawn trusted Phil absolutely. He praised her for her, quote, "unquenchable enthusiasm, unfailing fortitude, unflinching courage and devotion," close quote. When they were put on separate rope teams for an ACC climb of Mount Robson in 1925, Dawn remarked that it was the first time they had been apart on a serious climb, and they vowed that it would be the last. Phil played the climber's game so well that Dawn preferred her over any other climbing partner, male or female. The Mondays went to the mountains in search of many things. One of the most important was adventure, and the risk that went along with it. They sought out challenging situations that would expand the limits of their strength, and they found them. However, these experiences tested their limits in more ways than they had bargained for. In risking their lives, the Mondays also imperiled their beliefs and values. While they struggled to reproduce their city routines and positions in the mountains, they were occasionally forced to abandon them entirely, thus becoming aware of new possibilities. Near-death experiences can change everything. As Don Monday said of his, "We were different afterwards." Phil ceased to play the women's game whenever the situation demanded it. Usually, this was during climbs or other situations of risk. But there was one notable expedition in which she had to abandon it on an approach as well. This was on the single attempt on Mount Waddington that the Mondays made with another woman. In 1927, they convinced Phil's sister, Betty McCallum, to join their expedition. Once Betty found out what this entailed, she came to regret her decision. Betty was an ACC member, but like most members, especially most female members, she had no experience of climbing technical, isolated routes without a guide. Nor, it seemed, would she seek such experience out after this trip. Betty had an intense dislike for backpacking, and she could barely carry 20 kilograms at a time. To compensate for her smaller loads, Dawn carried about 40 kilograms, and Phil carried between 30 and 35. Although Phil and Betty started out cooking together, after a few days a routine was established wherein Dawn and Phil relayed loads while Betty cooked, set up camp, and packed up the loads. Betty played the women's game much more consistently than did Phil. Unable or unwilling to do heavy labor, she stepped in and filled much of Phil's usual role. Consequently, Phil was pushed into a no-man's land of gender on this expedition, continuing to do some of her typical jobs, but also doing much more physical labor than was normal for her. Ironically, it took the presence of another woman to make her step farther outside the bounds of accepted womanhood. It seems that she did not welcome this shift, complaining to her diary that she was tired of all the heavy packing and wished they had already climbed the mountain and were headed home. The next year, she resumed her standard role. By the time Dawn, Phil, and Betty reached the edge of the ice, Betty was already alternating between tears, sulking, and anger. Phil despaired of what to do. Betty finally, quote, admitted she did not love the mountains enough to work for them, close quote. However, there was no way Betty could return on her own, and the Mondays were not willing to take her back. Betty continued to complain, and her sister worried about her. Relations did not improve on the glaciers. The three climbers made a marathon 27-hour attempt on Mount Waddington. Phil moved into her climber's role. She led for much of the day, even after a rock smashed her head and she had gouged her arm, deflecting another rock from Betty. Betty, on the other hand, was not interested in learning to lead climb. She was in tears again and, quote, terribly grouchy, close quote. Dawn, however, was ready to try for the peak as soon as possible. Phil expressed some misgivings to her diary. She was tired, and she was also worried about her sister. Betty, clearly, still wanted to go home. Nevertheless, Dawn's wishes prevailed, and the three climbers set up a bivouac, or temporary camp, higher up on the mountainside. On the morning of the 17th of August, 1927, the three climbers awoke in their glacier bivouac at 3 a.m. Chastising themselves for having overslept, they hoped they would still be able to reach the summit of Mystery Mountain. They set out at 5 a.m., with no idea whether their route was feasible. It was possible that they would surmount a ridge only to discover an impassable gulf beyond it. However, their luck held, and the party advanced slowly towards the summit through a maze of, quote, the largest and most beautiful crevasses, close quote, Phil Monday had ever seen. By late afternoon, it was obvious that they could not reach the summit before dark. A storm was also blowing in off the ocean, blanketing the peaks below. The clouds rose and glowed an eerie red as they covered the setting sun. The wind immediately erased their footsteps. Still, the party pressed on to the base of the tower. At 6:40 p.m., with the weather worsening and fog and darkness setting in, Phil took a picture of Dawn and her sister gazing at the summit. The image conveys a sense of awe at being so close, along with resignation at, in Phil's words, being beaten once again. party turned around and began the descent. Phil was now leading. She and Don had been switching off leads all day. The mountaineers climbed 3 rock pitches, the second one by lamplight. Everyone's hands were numb and their clothes were frozen. The wind was biting cold, and thunder reminded the climbers of the approaching storm. On the 3rd pitch, the lamp carbide ran out, and they were forced to complete the climb in the dark. Then, suddenly, quote, "the heart of the storm seemed to leap the intervening distance in an instant. The night burst into crashing flame," close quote. Rain, snow, hail, and wind soaked the climbers and pinned them to the rocks. Lightning lit up the glaciers. The glare off the ice was blinding. Ice axes began to buzz with blue flame, which made them look like blowtorches. Sharp rocks had their own little tongues of fire, spitting and buzzing. Fingers, hair, hats, and clothing were, quote, "shooting and sizzling fire," close quote. In desperation, Phil, Don, and Betty located an overhanging rock by the sparks glancing off it. They stood balanced precariously over a chasm, teeth chattering, until the worst of the storm was over. At nearly 2:30 a.m., nearly 24 hours since they had last slept, the party arrived, freezing and exhausted, at its bivouac. A river was running through it. Quote, "food, wood, clothes, bedding lay soaking in running water," close quote. Quote unquote, "bed a lake," commented Phil in her diary. The party huddled under a tarpaulin and shivered until daylight. They were warm only where they were touching each other. At daybreak, they packed up their sopping, waterlogged gear and began hauling it down the mountain. The sun peeked out for a few minutes, and the climbers finally began to warm up. At 12:35 p.m., they reached their intermediary camp half asleep, where they had enough dry food for a small meal. The sun came out, they began to dry some of their belongings. A new thunderstorm rolled in, and they quickly packed up their gear and continued down to their base camp, arriving 39 hours after beginning the climb. Betty, according to Phil, was, quote, "all in and weepy," close quote. She insisted that Don and Phil take her out in time for the next steamer, and they agreed to do so. Betty's reaction is hardly surprising. This must be one of the most epic mountaineering days endured by anyone, ever. Many men would have been equally desperate to leave on the next steamer. Indeed, although Phil never mentions male climbers crying or complaining, very few of them were clamoring to return the following year. In fact, Betty was only invited after the Monday's other options, presumably all male, turned them down. Betty, however, behaved very much as most men would have expected a woman to behave in the mountains. She was never going to win at the climber's game, nor did she want to. She was tearful. She held up the expedition with her outbursts. She did not lead. She did not carry heavy loads. Betty's personal identity as a woman was incompatible with playing the climber's game, while Phil's was not. Although gender was important in the mountains, individual personality was a more central determinant of success. Phil and Don Monday were relatively equal climbers who were perfectly able, if need be, of getting a party up or down a mountain in the worst conditions. This is not to say that Phil always played the climber's game perfectly. Arguably in this case, both she and Don showed a serious lack of judgment in bringing Betty to Mount Waddington in the first place. A woman of better fiber than most, mountaineering and masculinity. It is not surprising that most other women, like Phil's sister Betty, had difficulty playing the climber's game. Historically, mountaineering has been a spiritual, moral, national, and physical quest, but it has also frequently been a quest for manhood. Climbing has always been a male-dominated sport. If nature makes most of the rules of the climber's game, then, historically, men have constructed the others. There are many ways to climb mountains, but mountaineering etiquette, especially in the 1920s and 1930s, reflected traditionally masculine values of daring, vigor, courage, physical strength, conquest, and subjugation. The mountains had become a man's world, and survival in a mountain environment demanded qualities that, in interwar Vancouver, men were far more likely to have had a chance to develop. Admittedly, increasing numbers of women did take up sports during this period. Some historians have dubbed it the Golden Age of Women's Sport in Canada. Yet women's participation in sport was a source of great controversy, and the debate was not just between men and women, most girls were still told, often by female educators and role models, that they should not be too muscular, that physical exertion could ruin their sensitive nerves, and that men did not like the look of athletic women. Middle-class women in particular often succumbed to the pressure to restrain from strenuous physical activity. In climbing mountains, therefore, Phil Munday pushed cultural boundaries as well as her own mental and physical limits. Coming to grips with the few women who played the climber's game could be problematic, particularly for male climbers. If men were supposed to be the only players who could win at the climber's game, then successful female climbers could only indicate one of two things: either women were not all weaker than men, or mountaineering was not that difficult. Few mountaineers would concede the second, and many were unwilling to agree with the first. Therefore, some would inevitably seek to discover a third explanation. Namely, they wondered if Phil Munday was somehow faking it. They wanted to believe that even the best female climber was not nearly as competent, as strong, or as brave as the average man. Indeed, Phil sometimes had to put up with attitudes of suspicion, hostility, or condescension. In 1926, she wrote in anger that Thomas Ingram, a friend with whom she had climbed many times, would not allow her to row, nor would he row where she directed, even though she had been up the inlet before and he had not. Another time, before she married Don, Phil and a female friend went on a trip up the Alouette River Valley, only to be turned back by the gauge reader, who categorically refused to ferry two women across the lake. The next time, Phil invited Don along, and the expedition was successful. However, Phil did not view all reactions to her gender as negative. Occasionally, she was simply amused or even touched. In one instance, two prospectors the Mundays had invited to dinner in the backcountry appeared with cuts all over their faces, later confessing that, quote, "in honor of the lady in our party, they had tried to shave with a knife," close quote. Another time, Phil was about to cross a bridge even shakier than the one in the Scarth Creek photograph. Another member of the expedition, Johnny, approached her and offered to take her pack across. Phil refused at first, but he looked her in the eye and said, "I'm single." Phil often retold this story. Quote, "It was something that impressed me deeply, to think that he thought that way," close quote, she said. Indeed, although Phil dismissed unwanted offers of help, she was not too proud to accept them when she was truly tired or scared. She considered it appropriate that a single man should put a mother's life ahead of his. Notably, though, Johnny made no offer to carry Don, the father's, pack across. Although Phil's gender sometimes caused her to be treated differently and limited her, she pushed these limits by playing the climbing game so well. She changed many men's prejudgments of her. Henry Hall, the climber who saw the photograph in the Canadian Alpine Journal of Phil crossing Scar Creek, was not the only man to make an exception for Phil in 1933. His hired packers, Pete and Ballot, were shocked when a woman arrived with the party. Out of politeness to their clients, they kept their misgivings to themselves. Later, when Phil had dispelled all doubts about her capabilities, Pete confessed to her that he had not relished the idea of a woman in the party for such a rugged trip. The suspicion surrounding Phil's abilities is also reflected in newspaper accounts of the Monday's activities. While Vancouver reporters knew enough about Phil to accept her as a skilled climber, British or American newspapers often assumed a woman climber could have made no significant contribution and did not even mention her in their articles about Mount Waddington. Phil constantly had to justify her worth, a task at which she was extremely adept, but a task nonetheless. In being forced to prove herself, she also proved the extent to which the climber's game was tied up in notions of masculinity. Even though Phil did not set out to break down gender boundaries, after climbing with her, few if any men could deny that she was an excellent climber. However, to many men, Phil was not a model to which other women could or should aspire. Rather than changing their beliefs about gender entirely, they chose to believe that she was a woman for whom exceptions could be made, not proof that women could climb as well as men. Don hinted that even he espoused this view, quote, "It takes a woman of better fiber than most to face exigencies of wilderness life without giving way to self-pity," close quote. Phil, it seems, was largely in agreement with this assessment. She wanted to be an exceptional woman. She took pride in being unique. When describing the hardship she underwent on the 1933 expedition, Phil commented, quote, No wonder Pete the Packer had been apprehensive about a woman member in the party. Close quote. She expressed pity, verging on condescension, for her sister Betty and the woman she climbed with on Mount Robson. Other women, it seemed, could only play their game. She was the only woman who, while remaining a real woman, could also play the men's games and win. Being the exception also allowed Phil, consciously or not, to play the climber's game without posing too much of an overt challenge to its rules of gender. Ideas about gender flow under the surfaces of human lives, pushing us in certain directions and limiting us in others. Like most people, Phil Munday did not overly analyze and investigate these currents. For the most part, she simply steered through them as best she could, with her eyes focused on the mountains. While Phil's climbing certainly had far more to do with gender than she realized or admitted, climbing was her great passion and an end unto itself. Nevertheless, whether or not she intended to do so, Phil questioned the belief that the ideal climber was necessarily male. When she displayed pride in her backcountry domestic abilities, when she looked out for the weaker member and insisted on compromise, prudence, and empathy, she also brought elements of traditional femininity into the mountaineering identity, elements as important to survival in the mountains as the more masculine ones of strength and daring. Phil's mountaineering adventures with Dawn were clearly what gave her life its greatest meaning and happiness. She did whatever was necessary in order to climb, successfully combining and manipulating gendered stereotypes to fit into a place that had its own exigencies and rules for survival. In doing so, she demonstrated the inconsistencies of the stereotypes themselves and the reluctance of even extraordinary people to reject them completely. Phil Munday is a reminder that life is always contradictory, compromised, and hemmed in by walls that are difficult to touch and define, let alone break down. Yet she also shows that sometimes, with enough determination, it is possible to find loopholes and boundaries and to accomplish things that, according to dominant reasoning, should be impossible.